Spirit will come to all of the courts and all those present, and all these passed away. I'm glad to see a call for this, you know, the other night for those members of the committee that were here listening to the testimony on 1050. You'll recall that Mr. Masofsky from Georgia Pacific made certain assertions about the certain agreements that he had made with Mr. Ed Whalen during the legislative assembly in 1965 on the way bill. And Mr. Masofsky, you know, upon my questioning, assured me that in fact that Mr. Whalen had talked to him about the elimination of the circuit court. I asked the committee to note that I talked to Mr. Whalen tonight, and he told me that Mr. Masofsky was mistaken, and that Mr. Whalen agreed to eliminate it with the self-insured. Now, I don't know how GP should have said that.
Let the record show that Mr. Whalen has always been.
Mr. Chairman? It didn't drop my attention that we could eliminate all of this House on 3323 and some other bills if we would adopt House Bill 2035, which deletes the state of Oregon's responsibility for the enforcement of the federal occupational safety.
Well, I figured you'd find that in the back of the book.
Yeah, that would.
I told you staff to rip that one out.
That would solve a lot of the problems faced in the state of Oregon. That's what the governor's decided to do with the water quality, you know. But
I'm going to open the hearing on House Bill 2671. This bill has had a previous hearing. Ed, I want you to be brief as far as, do you have amendments to this?
Yes.
If you'll bring them up, because I would like to get this taken care of. As I understand it, Mr. Capon has talked to me, and everyone that's an interested party in this matter is in agreement with your amendment. That would be question. Mr. Chairman, I'm Ed Capon, representing Multnomah County. As the chairman suggested, the interested parties, that being Multnomah County and the state, have since your request, discuss the amendments, and they are acceptable to all parties involved. The amendments very briefly do this. They relieve Multnomah County of the obligation of providing a specific list of inmates by name in order for them to come under witness compensation. We have a static situation where we have the same number of inmates, trustees working on the weekends, roughly 10 per weekend, but they aren't the same 10 trustees. The amendments also require us to provide a roster of those inmates who do serve in case there is a claim. It also states that we shall make a regular payment of contributions based upon the total number of such inmates carried on the roster. It's, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, as simple as that. It relieves Multnomah County of the hazard of not having coverage for those trustees that work during the weekend.
Representative Lindquist moves the adoption of the proposed amendments to House Bill 2671 of Multnomah County, dated June 8, 1977. I will go through the amendments briefly as I read them, Mr. Chairman, and if you follow to make sure that I have been right.
I guess that's probably the same as this.
At the end of June 16, with the ending of the sentence that says inmate, there will be inserted an additional sentence which will say the application shall also state the total number of inmates on the roster for which coverage is requested. The county or city shall notify the fund of any changes in the total number of inmates performing authorized employment. We then go down to line 19, and after the statute citation of 656.794, there's a comma inserted, delete the period, and add the following phrase, and shall require the regular amount of contributions based upon the total number of such
such inmates carried on the roster. The main four or main 20 is going to be deleting a large part of that, and the main four will start. The city or county shall maintain separate official membership rosters of inmates performing authorized employment, showing that there is each inmate became a member. A certified copy of the official membership roster shall be furnished to friends upon request. Period. Only those inmates whose names appear on such list prior to a personal injury by accident are entitled to the benefits of oral. So forth, setting forth the new statute. I mean, the present statute.
Correct.
Do I have a request?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
You've heard the motion. Is there any further discussion?
How about that?
Yes, go on here, please.
You referred to 10 inmates on weekends.
Yes, Representative Otto.
And what about during the week? They start under a different.
That's a good question. During the week, because there would either be days, there would obviously be days succeeding, preceding and succeeding the days they would be working as trustees, we had the opportunity under current law to let states know exactly who was going to work.
Right.
If a guy goes on to work on the weekend and it rains into Saturday, nobody's at home and safe, and they might not be covered.
Okay.
I appreciate the question.
Yes, Representative Warren, what do you assume the work with? Mr. Gill would probably be better equipped to answer that than
you.
That's
true.
Not either.
Minimum wage? The minimum wage rate would be the activity in which they're engaged in. They're in what stage is sweeping up the floor, there's a rate for that, and the whatever that classification might be. The assumed wage rate would be assumed wage of $200 a week. For the basis of what that generates enough benefits that if you're using the compensated to do the law provides almost
how many people collect?
Not very many.
We've had a pretty good experience in that respect. It's light duty work. Our only fear is not being covered. And not paying the appropriate premium to save. It isn't that we have a high risk factor, it's just that we have problems in the current law giving notice.
Well, actually, I guess you clarify.
I don't know the pay rate on that either.
You know,
I can't answer that, Representative Johannes.
I think, yes.
Kevin?
Yes, in this language, there's an inmate become a member. What does it become a member of? A roster? Is that proper terminology?
He's looking at on line 20, where the new sub 4 starts. It says the city of Thompson maintains separate official membership rosters of inmates performing authorized employment for the date each inmate became a member. And he's asking what the member refers to in his sentence. I interpret that as meaning became a member of the work team in which coverage should be provided.
And that's a long list, but they only use a part of them from time to time.
That's right, and it's very static. There may be 50 people as trustees who are entitled to work, but it's always 10 or 12 a weekend. And our obligation, if we change the average number to advise safe that it isn't 10 a week anymore, it's 12, and safe's response would be, okay, your premium thus is so much higher.
You remain with a little uncertainty, so it just seems like the certain ends are kind of hanging out in space. It became a member, and I don't know what to call it, but
it's a member of that work team. Yeah. It is a little awkward.
Okay. If it's clear to others, it's fine with me.
No, I think he's got a good question. Okay. Let me do this. I want to get rid of the bill, but I want it to be in a form that is understandable. What I'd like to do is to pass the bill out with the amendments, and the staff is going to work it over to make sure that it makes sense, that it's going to pick up the same concept. What I will do is I will distribute the committee report to the members, and if you don't like it and want it back, you can do that. But now it would be my intention to send it to the floor. Is that okay?
I can't see anything wrong with the reading as it is.
I'm going to look at it. I know what George is talking about, but there's a couple of things. Like, they refer to a roster in here, and I don't see any other place in the statute that refers to a roster. I don't know if the roster is a problem.
Yeah, no, I think if you get into so they're using inmates, so it's a standard procedure to have a roster within the situation where they have inmates working like that. In any jail, in any prison, that's the standard procedure there.
I think that's where we lifted the word.
They have to say that. I don't know if it's by federal law or state law or both, but they have to have a roster of where those men are at all times.
Correct. Okay. Representative Lindquist had moved for the adoption of these proposed amendments. Is there any further discussion? Is there any objection? Two amendments are adopted. Representative Lindquist moved House Bill 2671 as amended to the floor with a big pass recommendation. Is there any further discussion? Hearing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Lindquist?
Aye.
Representative Otto?
Aye.
Representative Riebel?
Aye.
Representative Rogers?
Aye.
Representative Starr?
Aye.
Representative Wilhelm?
Aye.
Jefferson Kulongas?
Aye. Amended House Bill 2671, as amended, will be sent to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Consent calendar granted?
Yes, we're going to put it on the consent calendar.
That takes an awfully long time.
Yeah, that's right. I don't want to do that. I knew it needed
to ask Bill Meade. Well, it's putting on Bill Meade.
Okay.
Is that engrossed?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, permanent engrossed. Okay, I best take care of that one.
Just carry that bill.
Representative Lindquist will carry that bill from Multnomah County. Not Representative the bottle. Multnomah County. It's always a decision. You can do that there.
I would be delighted to carry that.
I knew you would. Would you please inform Mr. Christ that Representative Otto is still carrying the cornerstone of his legislative package this session?
Mr. Chairman, Ron Particles is here to reply to that.
Mr. Christ should fail to get down.
I'm sure he'll talk to you today.
I work the floor.
The next bill I'd like to bring up is Senate Bill 1048. Excuse me, that's incorrect. I want to bring up 1049 because I want to get a public hearing on this. As you all know, this is the last bill in the series of the package that we've had that has not had a public hearing. After this, I understand that all the workers' comp bills that we've had would have had a public hearing, and we would be able to send them in to go into a work session on it. Mr. Bob Kennedy?
Mr. Chairman, committee members, Bob Kennedy, representing the Oregon AFL-CIO. The Oregon AFL-CIO supports Senate Bill 1049 AM Growth. In 1976, as per Mr. Carl Jacobson of the Workman's Compensation Board, there were 33,431 disabling injuries, which is of more than 3 days' duration. And of these, there were 7,249 permanent partial disabilities within the degree. National Commission on State Workmen's Compensation Law, pages 6869 of the 1972 report, and the U.S. Department of Labor report of Interdepartmental Workers' Compensation Task Force to the President and Congress of the Policy Group, dated 1-1977, pages 5-6, agree on wage laws. Quoting from the latter report, quote, although the permanent disability and death cases constitute only about 5% of the workers' compensation claim, they are responsible for about 50% of the benefit payments. With respect to these cases, we find excessive litigation, long delays in payment, high subsequent rates of persons without employment, and little relationship between the benefits awarded and actual wage laws, unquote. And I might add that our high unemployment problem in Oregon does not help in this area. And continuing to quote, a major part of the problem is caused by the settlement system, which focuses on terminating the liability of the carriers and employers, either by a compromise and release or by a lump sum or even for benefit arrangement, which attempts to foretell the amount of wage loss that will be sustained by a person with a specific type and degree of impairment. Studies for the task force indicated that such estimates are subject to large error. We in the Oregon AFL-CIO wanted the wage, the loss of wages to be covered in the settlement for permanent partial disabilities as well as impairment. As you can see by this bill, we have compromised by accepting an increase of $15 per degree. Our proposal would have increased workman's compensation premiums 156%. This is very unacceptable to all concerned that are trying to cut the cost of workman's compensation premium. The permanent partial disability amount per degree has not been increased since July 1st, 1971, when it went from $55 to $70 per degree. The cost of living increased in the same period by 55%. Some people think that workers are overcompensated in their benefits. This is not true, and as an illustration in the present schedule, for a loss of a hand, you will get $10,500. Now, I ask any one of you who will sell a hand for this amount, even though it would not affect your wages. I doubt if anyone would. A lifetime effect on experiences, normal activities, and personality, to say nothing of the pain and personal experiences for the rest of his or her life, in this case, because of problems with and caused by the appliance that he or she may be fitted with to help them perform a job. In our family, a member experienced this problem until the day he died because of the loss of an arm. With this proposed increase of $15 per degree, a person losing a hand would receive $12,750. This compares to $16,200 in the state of Washington and $21,770 in California. The provision that the second injury fund be used to provide assistance to employers that will hire a worker that has sustained such injuries that there may be a question in the worker's qualifications or ability to do certain jobs is a good provision. We like this as it may help our workers to be re-employed, and the more this happens could make the employers happy because the more injured workers that can return to gainful employment will reduce the workman's compensation payment. Then the Oregon AFL-CIO urges a D-PASS recommendation on Senate Bill 1049 A and Go. Thank you, Bob. Any questions? Thank you very much.
I was wondering, compared to the person losing a hand in Oregon, $12,750, the 16-2 in Washington, 21-something in California. At the same time, I know this is probably maybe related to a different thing, but we've been told that premiums are lower in the United States, and I was wondering how premiums can be lower, benefits higher.
Well, in the state of Washington, we appeal. That's the two-way bill, or two-way system. It had been the way to go, however, Senate Bill 376 didn't make it very far at this time. And anywhere from 6-20% savings. That's the ballpark figures that have been bounced around. So that's how the state of Washington saves some money. Down in California, I think that one of the things that happens down there that saves them quite a bit of money, they do a lot of compromise and relief. And I understand that courthouse halls are full of deals being cut there. And I just can't help but think the worker usually comes on the short side of the settlement down there. As in the state of Oregon, we do not have compromise and relief.
And you think that maybe the, like in California, the 21,000 figure, fairly high percentage, that might go to attorney fees?
Oh, I don't know about that. I was talking about it when you asked the question about the, I was looking at the premium and overall respect with regard to what they might affect the premium. And I'm talking about very expensive type of settlements, like on permanent totals. Just have, they have very few down there that's showing the records. And the reason for that is the fact that they're seeing arms. And so possibly some individual that maybe would have had to have $180,000 put in reserve for him if he were here in this state, maybe he might settle down there for $40,000 or $50,000. You can see that's quite a saving to the system by compromising and releasing on that basis.
Okay? Any further questions, Mr. Kennedy?
Good compromise.
Would you like to hear that?
No,
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 you don't. It's for all the things. It's late in session.
Well, I'm afraid of it. In the way the bill is written now, it refers to the word injury. And injuries, in my mind, did not take into consideration the pre-existing condition. And I think that to take care of the worker who comes to the job with a pre-existing condition is more important to use a certain injury upon the floor.
No, what I was going to say is that under the present system, isn't that the only purpose for which the second injury first one can be used?
Which
the workman must have had
a previous injury or a pre-existing condition,
which
could be a congenital condition, a heart condition, or spinal abscesses to the back, or any other condition. It may not be an injury on the job. But I think I'm concerned that maybe the way the bill is currently written could be interpreted that you have to have an on-the-job injury to be compensated under the second injury plan. I want to make sure that the language remains as it is today, that a pre-existing condition is also
Understand. That's
all I have.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
So, Mr. Chairman, go ahead, Bill.
If you were talking about this, someone with some kind of handicap that may or may not be associated with the work injury.
With the work injury, that's right. He comes to the job. He does come to a job and we realize from a pre-employment application or from something in the file medical examination. If the fellow has a condition that may be a handicap and it may result in another injury later on, we think the second injury fund should take care of this particular type of individual.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Mr. Chairman, I am Keith Wilson, the Attorney of Workers' Compensation Board. Let me comment first of all about Mr. Stanley's concern about this bill and say very candidly that this is precisely what the bill does. Over in the bill type on page 4, you'll note that the language in sub 2, the unit includes the employment of individuals who have incurred compensable injuries that result in permanent disability, which may be a substantial obstacle to employment. The board may provide, etc. The philosophy and rationale for that wording, Mr. Chairman, is simply this, that a second injury fund is generated by workers' contributions. We work for salaries or for wages. We feel that the second injury plan is administered by the board and supported through that resource should be limited to industrially injured workers who come to a job with a disability as a result of industrial injury. That if other handicapped people are to be brought into the system, then there must be a mandatory, must be some additional funding. And appropriately, that comes from the human resource part of our society, whether it's in the general fund or from some other source other than the funding that is contemplated by the second injury report. This is the only portion of the bill, Mr. Chairman, that I wish to testify to. This is a new concept of second injury plan in Oregon.
Okay, what I'd like you to do is I'd like to explain to the committee so that everyone knows exactly under the present law what the second injury reserve fund does, what its limitations are, and what this particular bill does to expand or whatever you're trying to accomplish with the policy matter.
The second injury plan, of course, is funded by 2 cents per day contributed by all salaried or wage earners, salaried earners or wage earners in the state. One cent of which goes to directly the second injury fund and generates approximately $1.8 million a year in that general area. The second
validated toward the construction of the new Wilson Bear Center in the equipment staffing area. The need for that second plant allowed the Workers' Compensation Board jurisdiction no longer be needed as of July 1st of this year. So we can turn that under the authority of the existing statute into the second injury plan. So it will accumulate 2 points instead of 1 point.
What is the current reserve of the second injury reserve fund right now?
The balance?
Yes, sir.
I don't believe I have a figure in the in the cause of the construction of the center, it's bound, but I don't know.
But since in July, we theoretically, you're going to be able to accumulate approximately $3.5 million this coming year, you know, in the second injury reserve fund.
Right.
Okay. What is the amount of average payout do you have out of the second injury reserve fund? Do you have any figure on that?
We can finish all these figures.
Did you do that?
Yeah.
So I understand.
We have that already worked up and started doing that, you know, we have.
This bill, 52831 in the deleted language.
Could you let me do this? Let me finish what it does okay. And how things are not going to get into the specific questions. I'm sorry, Chief, go ahead.
Well, we already had a second injury plan of one type or another for many, many years, of course, and in my view, the second injury plan there that we've had in the past has either functioned well to our satisfaction or really anybody else's satisfaction. We started out by a few years ago reimbursing insurance carriers for costs involved in second injury. We felt that was not working, so then the legislature at our request changed the law to its present wording, and we reimbursed the employer directly for a percentage of the additional claim costs that he was obliged to pay as a result of hiring a handicapped person. The problem with the present plan is that it sometimes takes several years for it to mature because the additional cleaning cost that is encountered may not develop under the rating plan for 2 years down the line. It's extremely complicated, difficult, and complex program to administer. Representative Lucas sat on the hearing committee, and I'm sure, and I do recall that he heard a great deal of criticism about our present plan. And as a result of that criticism, the board was instructed to appoint a secondary study committee and to come back to the legislature at this station and recommend something directed by the legislature to result of the study committee's findings, and that's what we have done. This is a completely new approach to second injury relief. It places in the hands of our service coordinators an easily explained, easily understood plan of incentive to a prospective employer to hire industrially handicapped people.
Okay, so the requirement for industrially handicapped individuals is still there.
That is in this plan. It hasn't been in the second injury plan up to now. It's up to this proposal.
What is the present application? Just anyone that has a pre-existing disability?
Long time. Congenital or otherwise.
Okay.
And the reason, as I stated before, that we recommend that the department is that if that type group of people who are admittedly deserving of the award. It should be assisted. Then additional funding should come from other sources. This plan that we're attempting here, of course, leaves a great deal to administrative definition and a plan which is fully placed out and developed by the board for its implementation. But in essence, what it does is place in the hands of our service coordinators a program that they can go to any employer and tell him that we will, if we will hire this individual, put him on the payroll, give him a chance that we will implement or subsidize his wages or salaries for a given period of time in a given facility. We're also asking for wide latitude to perhaps even assist that prospective employer in modifying the workstation so that an industrially handicapped person can function in the workplace. Just by virtue of some sort of modification that we can assist that employer in being about. We envision that we'll buy this device, which is simple, easily understood, that we can get quickly and employ to the benefit of the injured workers, greatly diminish the dying time of these people, save a great deal of money in reimbursable time loss that's presently being paid, or time loss at other times, and restore people to working capacity by this device. It's quite a radical departure from anything that's been tried in Oregon. And to my knowledge, and I've studied them all, this plan to me means more encompassing the basic philosophy of encouraging the hiring of handicapped people than any plan that I've ever seen. And I've never yet seen a plan that is generally accepted as being a good second injury plan. And I believe it has all the potential of developing into precisely that. If it's an answer. So,
okay, I've got a couple. Well, first is on page 4, down lines 28-31, where the language is deleted, defines a pre-existing disability. How long has that been in the statute?
Well, I think it's been carried forward for years and years, the representative Rogers.
So, it has been a part of the philosophy of second injury fund for many years, and now it's paid. Now, do you have anything that's going to replace this language so we would have a requirement upon the general fund to allow us to get these people who meet this definition into the employment market?
In other areas, by different types of programs and vocational rehabilitation and things and in the human resources area, there are programs to assist handicapped people in general or this type of disabilities to assist them in getting work.
Put it on a practical basis. If someone goes up to Gary Howell and applies for a job, and he meets this definition currently, they may find a job for him because they have this protection afforded by the second injury fund. They don't have to make pre-application to you or anything, as long as they are aware of this condition. Now, if we change this law, and the same individual goes up and makes application for the job, what are they going to do with it? Because can they afford to employ him with a congenital condition where they may take the full rap if he's injured?
Well, I don't know. Speaking of the housing and the other
things, I'm just using them as an example.
Generally, the large employers in this state look after their own injured workers very well, I think, generally speaking. They realize their own obligations with the worker and are anxious and willing to get him back into production. The cost of this bill really is toward the smaller type of employer.
Mm-hmm.
I would seriously doubt that Weyerhaeuser or Boise Cascade or some of the other larger employers in the state are going to be particularly attractive to this type of employer. But the bulk of employment in Oregon is by the medium and small type of employers, which I think will be attracted to this.
Well, I must not phrase my question for you. I'm talking about the guy who has not been injured, but would meet this definition here in the language that's being deleted of a pre-existing disability. How are we going to get him into the workforce if the employer who would otherwise hire him doesn't have the protection of the second injury fund? What protection does that employer have?
Well, by virtue of this bill, people who come to that employer with a congenital condition or a congenital handicap will not be allowed any benefit from the second injury fund.
And so therefore the employer might be very hesitant about hiring that individual.
Unless you can get some incentive or some relief from some other source. If general fund workers contribute to this program and look after congenital handicapped people, then that should be the source of that incentive rather than the contribution of industrial employed people.
As I understand it, from your previous testimony, you're saying there's a social policy. There's a policy decision since the second injury reserve fund is paid out of the working class pocket, that we should not have that money being given to people that have non-industry related disabilities and get the benefit of this job protection when it goes out there and seeks another job.
Yeah.
That's precisely right. And you think that the reason that the firm has had so many difficulties in the past is we tried to do too much with it and tried to encompass too many people within the ambit of the second injury reserve fund.
You see? And furthermore, it's so complex and always has been so complex that employers are not enough to really understand it.
In the MBO statute, it speaks about three different categories of people: prior accident, disease, or congenital defect. And you're substituting all three of those for the phrase industrial handicap.
Correct.
Now, what I want to ask you is that reading sub 2, there's a very broad grant of administrative power, because I see no guideline in it other than the general policy statement that should provide employment to individuals who have suffered permanent other industry injuries. And my concern is that the last sentence on 19, 20, 21, and 22. Because what you're basically saying is that we will decide who the second injury reserve fund payment should be made to
and there is no appeal from my administrative decision. Is that correct?
Yes.
Now, what is the policy for that?
Well, it's as long as the repeal of the administrative guidelines as adopted directly by the board should be clear enough so that the determination really not be any question about the qualification or the entitlement to the relief if the rules are properly drawn and drafted.
My concern specifically is the fact that you're saying as a policy matter that the second injury reserve fund will be used for reimbursing those employers who hire employees who have suffered injuries and other industrial accidents.
Yes.
That is a factual question. And I can see an employer and the board getting into a factual dispute of whether the accident was incurred within another industrial accident. And what you're doing by that last sentence saying, Andrew makes the final judgment on that, and there's no appeal for the employer.
Well, the matter of whether or not the man has ever suffered or has a handicap as a result of a prior industrial injury, the fact that she's in a situation not being out of yet by virtue of the claim file in this state or any other.
I understand what you're after.
And I don't, frankly, Chairman, I don't have any problem with here again, we're up against this capricious argument.
No, that's exactly what it is the same administrative decision that you wanted to be able to make this to vocational rehabilitation, and you're making it now to the second injury reserve fund.
And I'm just about to say that if this causes you any concern online, I think we'd be perfectly willing to delete that review, judicial review.
Here's what I'm thinking of. If a workman pays for that, he's putting his money in, and he may be the one that benefits from it, even though the money goes to the employee benefits. I see this program more as a benefit to the employee than I ever do the employer on the reimbursement idea.
Oh, no question.
The thing is that it's a very critical question to whether he's going to get employed, and I don't want to see the situation that we're getting into serious factual disputes that his employees should be reimbursed so that we give an incentive to him to hire these people, and there's no appeal from your decision, your administrative decision. That's the one thing that's concerned.
As a matter of fact, Mr. Chairman, the matter of entitlement would be settled before we even go into this program, because the thing would be implemented by a three-way contract with the employer, the Workman's Compensation Board, and the employee.
So we would have to identify the employee before we even enter the
employment. And what is industrial handicap work?
What's the process now for hearing an appeal on this decision under the present statute?
Does the employer have an appeal? Yes, he does have.
He's administrative procedures on it. And he can actually get up to the Court of Appeals on a real review.
Yes.
Okay, and the proviso in line 5, the thing that Mr. Thurman talked about, that ties in with the bird type on 15 through 22, the language there.
Yes.
And that's going to be a broad grant of administrative powers, and the injuries that you're talking about are those injuries that meet the qualifications enunciated in the policy in subparagraph 2.
Yeah.
Okay, and what's the new language in section 4?
Reimbursement claims of working beneficiaries. Well, it is deliberately broadened so that the form of assistance could be in various areas.
We didn't want to call it, we didn't want to limit it in scope. For instance, we may come up with types of payment to assist highly handicapped people beyond anything that we presently have in mind. So we use the word assistance advisedly. We spoke of wage incentives, we spoke of modification of workstation, things of that type, but there may be other types of assistance that we can give the employer.
Keith, I'm sorry, I've got enough. I'm talking about the new set for on line 14 to 19. And let me give you my concern. That's talking about the effect that even though you're changing the policy intent of the retroactive reserve fund, if you're going to continue to require payments out of the retroactive reserve fund, for those cases that occurred that were, you said, to those employees from the board that issued an order retaining eligibility for some payment prior to the effective date of the 77 Act.
Yes. So grandfathered in that.
Okay, but those are only for those cases in which the board has issued an order retaining eligibility. Now, what about those cases that the employer has hired the person under the present statute that you have an issue in order for eligibility?
And the thing is, this fund is encumbered. The applications that are on file and have been already approved and encumbered prior to the effective date of this act will be only be paid out of the fund.
Let me ask you another way. Before, even under the present statute, before a workman, an employer can get the benefit of the second injury reserve fund, he must have filed some eligibility document, and that must be on file.
Yes.
And what that aspect is saying is you're going to honor all this pre-existing eligibility.
Yes.
Chairman, I thought that under the existing law, if the employer had knowledge of this pre-existing condition, that he did not have to notify you and get any kind of a determination, unless an injury to that individual that was related to that disability actually occurred. Is that a misunderstanding on
the knowledge of your employer that the individual is a prerequisite to an entitlement? In other words, this position you can't get an employer incentive to hire somebody if he doesn't even know a handicap, if he didn't know going in. So that was the reason for that. An application, if he can show that he did have knowledge and that he did suffer a loss, additional premiums, physical loss to plant, or something of that nature, then he could qualify under our very complex rules that we've been operating on for the last 2 years.
Now, if someone has someone on board under the existing law, and we change this law, you don't know anything about it, but the employer does. And an injury occurs to that individual, will they still be covered under the second injury fund?
I got it. I don't believe so.
So it is not a true grandfathering them.
No. It's not grandfathering rules that are already established and approved.
I think that an employer may have hired someone in good faith who was disabled under this definition on lines 29 through 31. The person has not had any problem to this point. Subsequent to the enactment of this law, could have, and the employer is stuck.
Possibly so. On the other hand, if he comes to us and says that I can't put the the standing on the law is keeping that fellow. I had to protect the second injury starting now, it appears I don't. If it means that that worker is going to lose his job, and the employer is so serious about it, then the board under this, the regime of this law will be able to work with that employer and the injured handicapped worker to see to it that he is retained. Advantage of this new concept being extended to that report.
Where did you get that at?
It's the new section 4. Now, read the new section 4. What would allow them to do that? But that's a decision on your part, and what if the employer is not aware of this change in law? Now, I have to assume some of them are not going to know and are not going to be able to come to you beforehand and make this arrangement. I will request it.
Well, we've done everything we know how to educate the employer agents under our present program, and we haven't gotten the message out. There are certain sectors of employers that are taking an interest in it. But if we have a workable plan in the hands of our service coordinators that they can understand and they can explain, we think we can do a far better job of education. Frankly, Representative Rogers, I'm not sure that we've even started that particular problem a few years. I haven't, I know.
Here's the problem. I'm just thinking, if you have an employee out there, if the employee would mean he had a pre-existing injury under the present statute, but he doesn't have an over-determining eligibility,
he's still entitled to the payment out of the second injury bill fund in the present system.
No.
Present plan.
That's because he doesn't have the order. Determining eligibility.
Let me ask you this. You said in sub 4 on line 17 and 18, to those employers for whom the board is issuing an order determining eligibility, that's the retroactive application of this, of the plan. And I'm asking you if there are any cases out there where an employer would be entitled to reimbursement. And yet, he does not have an order from the board determining eligibility agreement.
And then this present order, unless he has an order of eligibility, his client and his application has been approved and his entitlement has been approved, but not paid out, those would be protected under this law.
Okay. But there are people under the present law, forget section 4, that do not have an order determining eligibility, isn't there?
Yes.
And that's what Representative Johnson said. And the problem is, and I'm just thinking now, is that if in fact an employee pays money to you into a fund, he has a property interest in it. And I'm not sure that you can cut him off.
Well, of course, his entitlement, there's no claim that your entitlement arises under a present plan until a loss has been incurred by that employee. In the form of additional
equipment. Okay, but say the guy has a congenital defect, whatever it is, and let's say it's not noticed in 2 years hence. But the employee knew about it before he came to work. Now he's covered under present law.
Yeah.
And his workman pays in 2 cents a day for 3 or 4 or 5 years. But the way this is written, in 2 years when he has injury, and it's a compensable injury, and he asks for reimbursement, you're going to deny it. And I'm saying to you, I don't know if you can do that.
Well,
because of the fact that that workman has paid money to that fund to cover his injury, he has an interest in it. And you've just cut him off from it.
My thing would be the same as I made to Representative Rogers, Representative Rogers. I don't believe that we even thought of that particular problem.
Okay, Chuck wants to say something.
He's getting ready. Chuck has an answer. Solution.
First of all,
the employer who pays the 2 cents a day and it gets exactly what he's entitled to under the law, and there's nothing taken away from him. It's the employer who recovers from it, he pays really nothing into it.
Mm-hmm.
And so the entitlement is not taken away from the man who's paying the cents per day in, creates the fund. You can grandfather in all those people that have listed the handicapped people if you wanted to. However, the board can change under the present system without legislation the rules in applying relief under Section 8 every time they want to. As long as they go to a public hearing as they did before, they changed it before. So the entitlement can change from time to time as a new procedure for second injury is developed. The uniqueness of this and the great value of this approach is that what's desperately needed in the law is not the reimbursement to the employer after the second injury, but the employment of those that are injured that can't find jobs. And it's difficult to find jobs. The second injury fund is presently constituted really only benefits a few large employers from the recovery process. This program will utilize the thousands of employers that we have in the state to hire men that have a difficult time finding a job because of industrial injury. A great, tremendous value in accomplishing some of the very things that we want to under the law. The problem of reimbursing the employers that have hired people because of handicapped conditions in anticipation that there's going to be an injury that might result in a greater disability than normally would occur because of that prior condition, are probably, honestly, very few and far between. There might be records of them. But I don't think they're hired for that purpose, primarily. They're usually on the payroll already, and the condition occurs, and they make note of it. And they look for that to accomplish some kind of relief.
Okay, sir. I understand that.
But it's a unique concept.
I think it's a good idea, really.
A super idea, and there really is no second injury fund in the United States today that's really accomplishing what
Chuck, let me answer this one question. The question of the appeal from the determination of whether the claim is compensable from the second injury reserve fund. Do you think this should be an appeal from that?
The way this is constituted, there really doesn't need to be an appeal.
Because it gets you out of determining eligibility, and you have to have that before you even consider the claim.
You're under a different concept now. The eligibility is really the only eligibility needed is that you've had a disabling injury. And it's noted here that the injury occurred, the job injury, and he's disabled. And so the criteria before was very complex. You had to have a second injury. You had to have a pre-existing condition. The second injury had to result in a greater disability than normally would have occurred. And so it was a very complex thing, and there was some room for questions. Here, this set of circumstances, there really doesn't need to be any kind of appeal because it's a matter of record that he has a disabled injury and it's already been decided.
Going on line 18, going to 19, in such manner and amount as the board considers appropriate. Now, isn't this second injury fund designed not to cover the basic injury that happened subsequent to the initial one, but the additional person caused by the
Yeah,
would pick it up in total. It's just purely a matter of negotiation with a prospective employer. What can we do within our limitations to have you hire this man? Is it 50% of the salary for the first 6 months? Is it 100%?
or what is it? Or do we modify his registration?
Okay.
The matter of contract will have to be, and the details of the contract are going to have to be very carefully worked out, because the employer has a very serious responsibility, but the employee also has a responsibility to give it his best shot. So we've got to ensure that those things.
So you're going to negotiate individually in every case. And it will be of the service side negotiation.
Precisely right.
Second concern is a misnomer under this. It would be the reemployment fund. And so the second entry does not need to occur. You can get right to the heart of the problem and not wait around for a second.
Well, did you think about renaming that thing while you were in the conference? So we didn't even get time to get to you. It takes a little while for it to come clear, because it's such a change of concept. It isn't
We've always said that the philosophy and the reason for second injury fund is to encourage the hiring of handicapped people. Mm-hmm. That's the reason for second injury fund. Mm-hmm. This does precisely exact that. Programs that this state and every other state have played around with and wrestled with since year one, none of them have ever really accomplished what we tried to do. This does exactly what we tried to do.
Thank you. Mr. Kalinowski, for the other people here, the bills that I'm going to put to the work session right after this are 2136, 301, and 302. And I'm going to try and take action on that. And the other bill, it appears that I will not get to because the fastest committee has a rule that I'm going to close down at 10 o'clock. So, Jack, if you have your minutes, Jack, well, there's no time except for another work session. If you give us your minutes and they start looking at these other bills, I'll set you up again. Come and testify, but I want the amendments to the bill that you have.
Mr. Chairman, the amendments have been presented. Your clerk has engrossed them. They're available, and I see they've been distributed.
What are you suggesting?
For the rest of my name is Jack Kalinowski.
Do you have any objections to the bill as it's presently written with the addition of your amendments? Do your amendments change the printed bill as far as the new amendments go?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. And since you're going to be holding another hearing on this bill, I will not discuss the addition to the new sections 5 and 6, I believe it is, that are proposed by our amendments. I think that's something that will take a considerable amount of discussion. But for the sake of time tonight, Mr. Chairman, I would like to restrict my comments to the bill as it has been discussed by the previous witnesses, especially addressing, if you will, the second injury fund. I find that respectfully I must take issue with the conclusions that Mr. Wilson and Mr. Gill have given the committee. Mr. Wilson, as I hear him, said that this concept that is in subsection 2 of section 2 of the bill is universally accepted. Mr. Chairman, I talked to representatives of several employer associations, employer groups, asking if the concept as described by your previous witness would be of any advantage at all in hiring handicapped people, and the answer was no, it would not. I can specifically tell you in our industry, in the construction industry, we would not consider any kind of reimbursement as
applicants as a part of salary to hire someone who has been handicapped. It would not serve as an incentive. The agriculture people, and their concerns about the cost of workers' compensation, have been advised that, I believe it was last year, if one permanent total disability was the result of an occupational accident in the agriculture industry, in which the reserve that the state accident insurance fund set aside was over $600,000 for one injury. An injury that resulted in a permanent total disability. You offer a construction contract of $500, $1,000, or $5,000 to risk that kind of liability. It is not going to be received. It will not be incentive in that case to hire a handicapped person. In those instances where we have exclusive hiring halls, such as most of the contractors that I represent, we simply, at the present time, cannot find out whether the employee that is dispatched to us by the labor union with whom we have a contract has any kind of a pre-existing disability, whether it be congenital, whether it be non-occupationally related, or whether it is occupationally related. We simply cannot find that out. Consequently, in our industry, as well as many others, incidentally, the current second injury fund does not work. We cannot find out if there is any kind of pre-existing disability. Hence, it is just simply not possible, unless that disability is extremely conspicuous, we cannot find out in advance that a disability exists. I would also, Mr. Chairman, have to take issue with the conclusion that is reached in the present subsection 2, that the second injury fund should be restricted to only those who have suffered occupational injuries. Every workman who labors in the state of Oregon contributes to the second injury fund. There are a great many workers in this state who have pre-existing disabilities. Any one of the three conditions that I mentioned before. An epileptic may be working and contributing his money to deny him the opportunity to have some kind of benefit to encourage employment because he is an epileptic seems to me to be highly discriminatory. The whole purpose of the second injury fund is to encourage the hiring of handicapped, and it should be made to work that way. Whether or not that handicap dates from the birth of the individual, something that was incurred through some other kind of non-occupational injury, or as a result of some kind of occupational injury. If you're talking simply about equity, I do not understand how anyone can support taking money, albeit a somewhat small amount, from someone who has a pre-existing non-occupational disability and then denying them the benefits that should accrue to him through this fund. Our amendment, Mr. Chairman, awful lot more towards hiring the handicapped. What we're suggesting here is that you, in essence, to a great degree, remove the financial liability that employers risk when they hire anyone who has any kind of pre-existing disability by utilizing the second injury fund to pay medical costs that occur when an injury, a second injury, does result. And it is found that that individual who has suffered this second injury does have a pre-existing disability. It seems to me, Mr. Chairman, that if the second injury fund would be used for this purpose, and if there is no requirement that that employer have knowledge of any pre-existing disability, we're going to remove the fear that employers have from hiring somebody who is handicapped, at least to a greater degree than ever before. I would just perhaps remind the committee of some very important but a very brief statistic. It seems like every year in Oregon we have 36,000 disabling injuries, 6,000 of which result in some kind of permanent disability. It's only 30,000 injuries that occur every year in Oregon that do not result in permanent disability. I guess what I'm saying is that the possibility of hiring a handicapped person and then using the second injury fund to pay his medical costs will accrue in a great many cases to those who do not have permanent disabilities resulting. That way, I think you're going to have a greater amount of encouragement to employers to hire handicapped people. The program, as outlined by Mr. Wilson, simply will not be any kind of encouragement.
Okay. I don't want to get into a discussion with you tonight on it, but so I can just look at it. I understand what you've done with your amendments as to the critter bill, but you're missing Section 5. What you have done is you've added the amendments to 2, the 6-5-6-2-3, 212, and 268. They have nothing to do with the second injury reserve fund, do they?
Well, Senate Bill 1049 relates to more than one subject, permanent partial disability.
No, I understand that, but
you're right.
It doesn't have anything to do with the general tenor of 1049, which is the second injury reserve fund. Like 268, Jack, is in 1050. And if you want to play around with that particular provision, that statute is in 1050.
It is amended. This was proposed as an amendment to this bill because Senate Bill 1049 does increase the amount of benefits payable for permanent partial disability. And this, the new language that we're proposing would
adjust the screen around at 268 again, which is the determination of when a person cut off a temporary total, which is exactly what we've been fighting in 2237, which we put out, which is the bill we went through already.
Well, Mr. Chairman,
I'm not saying you can't do that. I'm just saying that I'm trying to do administrative. That's what you've done.
I understand.
Is that correct? Because I want to know if, in fact, because I've read the amendment, and I don't see what it's doing. We've acknowledged it doesn't do anything with the second injury reserve fund. We're after the partial, permanent partial award in the front of the bill that we're talking about. And that's what the new amendment suggests.
Yes.
Okay. So I understand that.
The manner in which permanent partial disability determinations are made.
Thank you, Jack. I'm going to set this up for another hearing, and we'll have you back again and go through all the amendments with that. And of course, the hearing on 1048 that Sal has testified, I'd like to very briefly bring up the following bill.
You closed the hearing on 1048.
Yeah, it's 1049. 1048, 1050, I'm not going to get to them. A call, Mr. Stern. I know this is Bill Val tonight because it's Central. The first one is Angel Central 301. If you recall, this is that bill that had to do with third party lawsuits in regards to the indemnification agreement. If I could tell you what the problem was, but remember on the floor, I had two types of the committee. Jack, if you could answer this, let me go. Well, that's okay. I just wanted to let him know I've got the bill up and I'm going to show you a minute. So I know it's always going to testify. If he wants to come in and listen to this, he can. Yeah. 401. He wrote me a letter on it. And if you look at lines 17 through 19, the problem is that it says except as provided in paragraph 3 of this subsection, all agreements or arrangements contrary to the provisions of paragraph 4 of this section are void. There's a serious question of whether that's unconstitutional and that. Boarding current existing contract, which is a constitutional prohibition against, and those agreements that have already been entered into. I'm not convinced that, I think it's a serious allegation that I do not believe the legislature can pass a statute boarding those contracts that are already presently in existence. And what the proposed amendment is going to be to you is that it's going to basically say that paragraph 2 of subsection 1 of 656-018 applies to agreements that are one and given to or removed after the effective date of this act. Carl, did you understand that? Have you got the amendment? Yeah, that's exactly what I'm going to do. I don't know if I want to. That's good.
Yeah.
What are we talking
about?
Okay, have you got the bill? Yeah. Okay. Representative Lee, what's new? The adoption of the committee's proposed amendment to Angel Central 301. It appears that on line number 6, section 2, there will be a period of sub-1.
Have we had a hearing on this?
No.
Mm-hmm.
And if I spend my money,
I'd move it. Don't do that.
itself. I don't like the amendment.
That we've got to close.
I was going to ask you, what was your objection to
the it's clear it doesn't. The problem is it's just a lot of wording. It doesn't need to be there if, in fact, the Club C was really popular.
If you want to work more than instructions
from the SEC,
avoid. Yeah.
Okay.
Let me do that
again. Yeah.
You avoid that. You'd like to find out, right?
Yeah. Okay, so what you're saying, let me read it again to you. Except as provided in paragraph B of this subsection, all agreements are void and contrary to the provisions of subsection B of this subsection, and not in existence on the effective date of this act, are void. Okay.
I discussed this thing with Pete Geisner from the Hospital Association, and he says that if there was some provision made whereby the hospital could notify someone either locally or through the toll-free line, they can make this report at the time of the admittance to the hospital. Because then they're processing paperwork about that. He didn't look, thought it was great relics, but he agreed that that was probably the appropriate, that was probably a very appropriate time to do this. I didn't realize we were going to come up on this thing tonight. And so I don't have any amendments prepared for this, but this, we talked about this, we talked about it last session, talked about this session, about getting some kind of an immediate action. And I just can't see where 30 days is that immediate. I was talking with a young woman tonight on the telephone whose husband is in the hospital as a result of the injury. And there's just a lot of things that they don't know yet. He's been in the hospital a month and a half, and still in the hospital. And now the Workman's Comp Board is involved in it, safely involved in it, but it didn't happen as quickly as it could have. And,
so, why don't I do this? Why doesn't Anita see you tomorrow?
Okay.
And you two talk, and I need somebody from the board to talk with them also as to the 30-day requirements of this memo so that we don't do anything that's going to scuttle the whole program. Mm-hmm. So on Wednesday, that bill will be brought up for a work session agreement, and if there's any amendments to it, it will be put out of that room. And of course, the hearing on Senator 302, I'd like to move very quickly to House Bill 2136, and it's the last one this evening. Now, if I could, please, this is the bill that we have to do with the vacation and holiday pay. The agreement that we have from all parties is we're going to leave the vacation pay alone, and there's going to be no change in the existing law on that. We're going to attack the problem of the holiday pay. Libby, it's been so long since you've been before the committee, and it took you a good night for you to do it.
Back in the 2nd of February, she was going to give us amendments.
Then he wanted to take the meeting to sign with the amendments for our board system.
Let me know, Supervisor Bancroft, to the Retirement Division. You have before you two proposed amendments, marks A and B. They're identical except that A has an extra sentence in the holiday pay, which would, if the payment for the holiday is not made within 30 days following the end of the week in which the holiday falls, then it would not be deducted. And the reason that we suggested this was we had trouble. We have had trouble at times when we were deducting holiday pay with the situation where a company would perhaps go down with a number of people. One I'm thinking of had over 300 first part of January, and January 1st is a holiday. Those people would not get their holiday pay for January 1st until they went back to work. One I'm thinking of would be determined at first that it could be deducted, so we deducted it from that wage. And in the long term, the unions and verified by the employer, they were never going to reopen. So therefore, we reimbursed everybody for what we had deducted, and on July 1st, they reopened, and we had to go back and set up overpayments. And what we'd like to do is say, after 30 days, which is a normal pay period, if the holiday pay hasn't been received, then we would disregard it as a deductible earnings. The other amendment, B, does not have that sentence in it.
Of Amendment A
that the understanding that the current bill is going to be put back in the terminology of the present statute, and what we're going to add is the new Amendment 7.
That's
what it says, yeah. Is that it? No, we've heard the amendment. Is there any further discussion?
Does this resolve the problem that was brought forth by Tektronix and OMAX?
So back there, we're in agreement with this particular proposal that handles this bill.
Okay.
Yeah, all of a sudden goes in. Basically, all we're going to do is if you were looking at the present law, it's going to be a new sentence.
That's exactly what you're doing. Would you like to stick this amendment into some kind of side track and vote against part of the amendment and file part of it, or do you have your full vote?
It's essential.
Well, I've got no problem with this on page 3, after 7. Going on through there, but I think that the employment division had made a pretty good point for the changes that are contained on page 2.
Okay, earlier. So, the problem is I can tell you, you will certainly jeopardize the bill if you do that. And the most important thing for them is to get the holiday thing set up, and that's why I want to do it as a clean bill to get that issue, so that no other issue is being thought out in this thing. And the whole thing goes down. Any further discussion? Did we move forward after you move? This is what it is. Okay. Is it adoptable? Okay. Is there any objection to the adoption of the amendment?
That part of it, no.
Okay. The amendment is adopted. Representative Lindquist moves that House Bill 2136 as amended be reported to the floor with a recast recommendation. Any further discussion? Is there any objection? Please call the roll. I'm sorry. Green is.
Representative Lindquist?
Aye.
Representative Otto?
Aye.
Representative Weibel?
Aye.
Representative Rogers?
Aye.
Representative Starr?
Aye.
Representative Wilhelm?
Aye.
Representative
Aye.
Amendment House Bill 2136 is sent to the floor with a due test recommendation.
Do you want that in growth?
Mm-hmm. Yes, I want it in growth.
2 years to go, so I'm getting. I'm still not going to carry the damn thing.
You want to carry that?
No, I think you should be wonderful.
Bill, why don't you carry that? Bill, all it's going to do is you know, holiday pay is the only thing you can do with holiday
pay. I believe you.
That was my fault for not
informing you about
it. It's just under the assumption that we were only going to handle that issue. I know what you want. I'm not going to fight that out now. I know you tried. It was a very rigorous,
not a time, real good.
Let it? Yeah. That's all. I appreciate you waiting 15 minutes with me and hearing the game.